observance of the International Quds Day, established in 1979 by Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, has become a global tradition of marches and conferences advocating for the Palestinian cause. His appeal for global solidarity continues to resonate worldwide. Africa is part and parcel of this international movement in support of Palestine. Now, let's start off with Dr. Firoz Osman. How has the International Quds Day contributed to raising awareness about the Palestinian liberation struggle across the African continent?
The Iranian Revolution in 1979 was a true revolution. In other words, many of the other revolutions that have taken place did not remove the institutions and the deep state. For example, what happened in Egypt. You know, it lasted a year and then it was overthrown again. And the old systems and their controllers came back in power. So it is probably the, in recent memory, the only true revolution. And it is quite remarkable for Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, that in 1979, he already declared Al-Quds Day. It showed their determination to free the third most holiest shrine. And it is a day that has been commemorated now ever since 45 years or plus. And it has created a global phenomenon, not only in Africa, as we mentioned, but throughout the world, where Palestine has been brought up into the map. Many others are gaining, given under the current circumstances, what is happening in Gaza, that they are getting courage from what has been happening in Gaza. There is no doubt that, you know, it is Iran that stands against the world system that wants to occupy and oppress people, and it is the Palestinians in Gaza that is fighting the same phenomenon with a great deal of courage, looking to Al-Quds for their liberation, to all countries that are helping them. And in fact, you know, it is the protest marches that began right in Iran in 1979 that continues till this day.
Thanks for that, Dr. Osman. Now let's bring in Hassan Loget. At the 30th African Union Summit held in Addis Ababa last February, African leaders took a strong position against Israel, denouncing its assault on Gaza as genocide and demanding a halt to all cooperation until the Israeli occupation ends. Now, how does Africa's steadfast support for Palestine pose a significant challenge to Netanyahu, who has spent the past decade working to expand Israel's influence across the continent?
The 38th African summit, the AU summit, held in Addis, was very significant because it suggested for the first time that Africa was uniting once again behind Palestine. We have to go back many decades, I think in the early 1980s, when the Organization of African Unity was at its height, trying to create a program for the liberation of the African continent from colonialism and apartheid, that they made a statement in the founding declaration of the African People's Charter, African Charter for Human and People's Rights. And that charter, also known as the Banjul document, was very, very instrumental in putting Zionism as one of the targets. And I wanted to quote a little bit of it. The charter basically said they wanted to achieve the total liberation of Africa, of peoples which are still struggling for their dignity and genuine independence, and undertaking to eliminate colonialism, neocolonialism, apartheid, and Zionism, and to dismantle aggressive foreign military bases and all forms of discrimination, particularly those based on race, ethnic groups, color, sex, language, religion, or political opinion. So it looks like this was a victory for the progressive forces led by South Africa and Algeria.
Ties between the Israeli apartheid regime and the African Union significantly worsen after Israel's assault on Gaza in October 2023, which led to mass atrocities and genocide, resulting in the deaths of over 50,000 Palestinian women and children. Across Africa, people have gathered in massive numbers for rallies in solidarity with Palestine, especially during International Quds Day. These demonstrations impacted the African Union's policy decisions.
The African Union is pivotal. It is important for increasing pressure on the Zionist entity. If we recall way back in 1973, most African countries, almost all bar one or two, broke their ties after the oil embargo in support of the Palestinians, in support of the Arab world. However, the Zionist entity's aim is to bring about a change in Africa, in the African nation states, through the observer status in the African Union. We know a year or two ago that South Africa played a pivotal role to remove the Zionist entity from its observer status in the African Union, despite the fact that some of the African Union member states wanted Israel to be present. You see, what the Zionist state does is to use its soft power, its technology, its military, where they bribe and blackmail and trying to influence the African nation states to support Israel against the Palestinians. And this is where, again, the Iranian Islamic Republic of Iran has played an important role. It is also important for other Muslim nations to be aware of what is happening in parts of Africa and to help the African nations to ward off the soft power that the Zionist entity is using.
Many African countries are actively forging stronger ties with global powers that challenge Western dominance, such as China, Russia, and Iran. These alliances grant them greater political leverage, enabling them to take more independent stances on international matters, including the Palestinian issue. The evolving geopolitical landscape has played a key role in further isolating Israel's apartheid regime in Africa.
Where you find Israel, you find conflict. And I think that the countries that want to turn away from conflict have to find a path of peace and are looking for other ways. In the Sahel region, a number of countries have kicked off the leadership military alliances with France. But as I pointed out earlier, we need to negotiate new terms of engagement and relationships with countries like Russia, and so that we do not find ourselves a few years down the line with someone that we cannot live with. We need to live with countries that will affirm African values so that Africa can use its own minerals for its betterment. And we can't replace one set of dictators for another. So yes, getting France out has been strategic, but Africa must renegotiate its terms of engagement with other countries on its own politics, its own agenda that's African-centric. And Kwame Nkrumah was very, very clear that Africa's got a long way to build a United States of Africa where all our resources could be used to uplift our own people.
The comparison between the Israeli regime policies towards Palestinians and the deposed South African apartheid regime has been made by both scholars and political leaders. Now, Dr. Osman, this is for you. In what ways do you see these parallels playing out today, particularly because Western powers, which once supported the apartheid regime in South Africa, are now backing the Israeli apartheid regime?
South Africa under apartheid is exactly the same as apartheid in Israel. And this is said very clearly by our first president, Nelson Mandela. It was said by our moral voice in South Africa, Bishop Tutu. In fact, they didn't say it's exactly the same. They say what is going on in Israel is worse than what has happened in South Africa. that the apartheid there is worse. And we can see it from the genocide. In fact, the Media Review Network commissioned a book, and it is entitled Why Israel? The Anatomy of Zionist Apartheid, a South African Perspective, where it makes very clear the parallels between what was under apartheid in South Africa and what is apartheid in Israel at the moment. And in fact, it's become so obvious that it is no longer a debatable issue. The reason for the support of Zionist apartheid is that the same countries that supported white apartheid racism in South Africa are supporting the Zionist Israeli state, such as Germany, United States of America, Great Britain, France. All of them supported white South Africa until it became untenable, until they could no longer control it and could not stop it. So these are the same racist white settler colonial regimes that are supporting Israel today. And in fact, we can see that what is going on with the Trump administration today, that it is white settler colonialism.
Well, thanks for that, Dr. Osman. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on Africa's solidarity with Palestine as we mark the International Courts Day. Stay with us.
Africa backs Quds liberation.
In late 2023, South Africa filed a case at the International Court of Justice over the Israeli apartheid regime's genocidal war on Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. Ron Lamoda, the current South African foreign minister, speaks here at the ICJ, where he led his country's legal team while serving as the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services. Let's take a listen.
Thank you, Madam President, and distinguished members of the court. It is an honor for me to stand here in front of you on behalf of the Republic of South Africa on this exceptional case. In extending our hands across the miles to the people of Palestine, we do so in full knowledge that we are part of a humanity that is at one. These were the words of our founding president, Nelson Mandela. This is the spirit in which South Africa acceded to the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Crime of Genocide in 1998. This is the spirit in which we approach this court as a contracting party to the Convention. This is a commitment we owe to the people of Palestine and Israelis alike. As previously mentioned, the violence and the destruction in Palestine and Israel did not begin on the 7th of October 2023. The Palestinians have experienced systematic oppression and violence for the last 76 years.
Well, South Africa's case at the International Court of Justice has been described as both a legal and moral stance against the genocide in Gaza. Now, Mr. Logan, this is for you. How significant is this moment for South Africa's history, given its own past with apartheid, and how does it shape its role in global justice and human rights advocacy?
We have to find whatever means possible to preserve a sensible system in the world, a system of equality amongst nations, so that the rule of law, international human rights law, can actually prevail. At present, Trump wants might to rule, not justice, might. And I think South Africa is correct in building these alliances. Our ambassador was declared a persona non grata in America, and Trump has basically asked him to leave the country. This is Ibrahim Rasool, for simply speaking at a web conference in this country, Mistra, where he basically said that Trump and him are fearing the increasing numbers of black and brown peoples in the world, in America, that are beginning to have influence. And he implied that they were trying to preserve white supremacist politics. None of that is untrue, but he's chosen to punish South Africa. So Trump and him are being vindictive, not only to South Africa, but anyone who dared to oppose them, even people in his own party. But South Africa is being bullied. Unfortunately, there are a number of people in our country who actually support Trump, and they happen to be from those who are privileged, happen to be largely white.
Julius Malema, the leader of South Africa's Economic Freedom Fighters Party, frequently takes part in demonstrations backing the Palestinian resistance. In this speech, he expresses his support for Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement. Let's tune in.
What type of a government do we have in Israel that goes and bomb a hospital where people have run away for refugee, where people are sick, where children are there, where pregnant women are there? You bomb a hospital and you say you are looking for Hamas, but you are killing innocent children. There is nothing wrong Hamas did. This folk tongues and people speaking in parables and we don't know what they are hearing, what they are saying, it's wrong. When you are oppressed, the only option you have is to fight. And that's what Hamas is doing. They are fighting for their freedom. Mandela did the same thing, took up the guns and fought for the freedom of the people of South Africa. When you are oppressed, you only have one option. Confront the enemy and shoot to kill. Do not kiss the enemy.
South Africa's liberation hero, Nelson Mandela, became known and respected all over the world as a symbol of the struggle against apartheid and all forms of racism. He was steadfast in his support for the liberation of Palestine. He famously stated that, "We know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians."
Mr. Alogat, you have the last word. How can events like the International Courts Day be leveraged as a platform to advance Nelson Mandela's vision of a free Palestine and turn his aspiration into a reality?
When the late president, liberation hero Nelson Mandela, said, "Our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of Palestinians," he basically drew inspiration from the time when the ANC in exile was trained and supported by the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It was a unity built in the trenches. And when he went to America, they tried to ask him to disassociate from Arafat and the PLO and Fatah. And he said, when days were dark and friends were few, only Palestinians, Libya, and other countries stood by us while others ignored us. And really, this is the message of Sumud, as the Palestinians say, the steadfastness that Iran and other countries, the Houthis, Lebanon and others, have been very principled in their support for Palestine. Cuba too, they want nothing in return. They support it not because they desire critical minerals, as Trump wants, from the Ukraine. They support it because they believe every nation has a right to determine its own destiny. Every nation has a right to self-determination. And we have fought a long battle, and we are still continuing given the nature of our settlement, and we want to lend a hand so that Palestine one day can be a truly independent state of all its people.
Well, thanks a lot, Hassan Logat and Dr. Firoz Osman, for your incisive analysis. And now we welcome you on Palestine as we mark the International Courts Day.
Search for my roots in this soil, this holy land. which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth, glorious land, now I offer my son to you. See, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms. I put him on your chest, still in red, to water you, you who have my room. Since the story of my anger and your blood, the story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry, have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since somebody inside my aching heart, somebody inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice. Your blood roots me here, this land, your blood, my heart.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Technology billionaire Elon Musk has lashed out at US judges as they rule against his Department of Government Efficiency. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Thank you. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story and tells us more. In the days after a federal judge ruled Elon Musk's dismantling of US aid likely violated the Constitution, the world's richest person issued a series of online attacks against the American judiciary, offered money to voters to sign a petition opposing activist judges, and called on Congress to remove his newfound legal opponents from office. Elon Musk wrote on Wednesday, 19th of March, "This is a judicial coup," and he asked lawmakers to impeach the judges. Elon Musk, who serves as a senior advisor to Donald Trump, posted about judges who ruled in opposition to the administration more than 20 times within 48 hours this week on X, the social network that he owns. He repeatedly framed them as radical leftist activists, and he sought to undermine their authority. His denunciations came as his so-called Department of Government Efficiency faces sweeping and numerous legal challenges to its gutting overhaul of the government, which has involved firing thousands of government workers and gaining access to sensitive government data. The Department of Government Efficiency is a subject of nearly two dozen lawsuits, which in some cases have already resulted in judges imposing more transparency on Elon Musk's initiative or reversing parts of its rapid-fire cuts at federal agencies. The legal pushback poses one of the most significant challenges to Elon Musk's plans, which for weeks after Inauguration Day involved operating with expansive powers and little evident oversight. While Musk posts online, he is also directing some of his immense wealth towards those who support his cause. Musk donated funds to seven Republican members of Congress who called for impeaching judges, the New York Times reported, giving the maximum allowable donation of $6,600 to their campaigns. Elon Musk also launched a petition on Thursday, 20th of March, against activist judges via his political action group, America PAC, which offered registered voters in Wisconsin $100 if they signed. Elon Musk's America PAC has funneled millions of dollars into the state's 1st of April Supreme Court race, in which he's backing a former Republican attorney general in another attempt to reshape the country's courts. Elon Musk's campaign against judges has intensified amid a wider clash between the Trump administration and the judiciary over the rule of law, following court decisions who push back against the administration's mass deportations of immigrants. It follows long-standing behavior from Donald Trump to rail against judges that have ruled against him in cases concerning his businesses or personal matters. The White House's fight with judges escalated to the point where John Roberts, the Supreme Court Chief Justice, issued a rare public statement on Tuesday defending America's judicial system. John Roberts wrote, "For more than two centuries, it has been established that impeachment is not an appropriate response to disagreement concerning a judicial decision. The normal appellate process exists for that purpose." Elon Musk, however, responded to John Roberts in a post on X, formerly known as Twitter, just one day later. Elon Musk wrote, "For more than two centuries, there has never been such extreme abuse of the legal system by activists pretending to be judges. Impeach them." Labor groups, watchdog organizations, and former government workers have filed lawsuits in response to the Department of Government Efficiency's blitz through federal agencies in late January and February, alleging that Elon Musk's initiative acted without legal authority and violated laws on privacy and transparency. Although the justice system's response is not as rapid as the breakneck pace of Department of Government efficiency's cuts, several of the cases against Elon Musk's efforts are now beginning to throw up roadblocks for him and his team. A federal judge in Maryland ruled on Tuesday that Elon Musk and the Department of Government Efficiency's shutdown of USAID, the agency that provided humanitarian aid and one of the first in Elon Musk's crosshairs, was likely unconstitutional. The justice ordered the Trump administration to halt terminations of employees and reinstate their access to certain computer systems. Department of Government Efficiency had dramatically taken over the agency in early February and moved to close its operations, which Elon Musk boasted involved feeding U.S. aid into the wood chipper. Judge Theodore Chuang found that Elon Musk's actions at the agency likely violated the Constitution, given his role as an unelected advisor who did not undergo Senate confirmation. Department of Government Efficiency faced another setback on Thursday as a different Maryland District Court judge temporarily blocked Elon Musk's team from accessing Social Security Administration systems. A lawsuit against Department of Government Efficiency argued that granting access to millions of people's personal data at the agency violates privacy laws and represents a security threat. Another district court ruling last week ordered the Trump administration to reinstate probationary workers who were fired en masse at 18 government agencies, while a separate case compelled Elon Musk's team to produce internal records about its staff and operations. As Elon Musk and Donald Trump officials have ramped up their attacks on judges, multiple justices told Reuters news agency earlier this month that U.S. marshals warned them they are facing unusually high threat levels against their personal safety. Elon Musk has reacted to the court decisions with outrage and unsubstantiated accusations that the judges are rogue activists who must be stopped. On X, the Tesla CEO has amplified far-right influencers who have called for impeaching justices or targeted specific judges in posts. "An activist judge is no judge at all, just someone wearing a costume," Elon Musk responded to a post from right-wing commentator Matt Walsh that suggested Donald Trump should go to war against activist judges. Elon Musk has also received support from foreign leaders who have attacked their country's judiciaries and challenged the rule of law. He responded with a 100 emoji to a post from the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that claimed when a strong right-wing leader wins an election, the leftist deep state weaponizes the justice system. Benjamin Netanyahu attempted in 2023 to weaken the power of Israel's judiciary, prompting nationwide protests and fears of a constitutional crisis. El Salvador, where President Nayib Bukele's party ousted all Supreme Court judges in 2021 as human rights groups warned about a slide into authoritarianism, has become a repeated point of comparison for Elon Musk. He retweeted a post from President Bukele on Tuesday that claimed the U.S. is facing a judicial coup and repeated that language himself in later posts on X.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, keep iftar simple.
Bismillah Rahman Rahim, welcome to said with me, Sister Zainab here on IMP English Radio, and obviously the title is self-explanatory, and it's this sort of constant reminder that I also make, and probably many people make, that, you know, we're not, that look, there's very many good reasons why we should keep our iftar simple, and we can include suhoor, but obviously people don't usually have so much time to make the suhoor meal so lavish. But, you know, quite apart from, obviously, if we keep the iftar simple, it means we're spending less time preparing, which means we've got more time for reflection, for dua, reading Quran, and so on during Ramadan. If we keep iftar simple, also means we're not spending quite as much money for the iftar, which means maybe we've also, in theory, got a bit more money to give to charity, to give the people in need. But there's other, even deeper reasons. You know, every single reason has many depths and layers to it anyway. But look, so there's a particular aspect of extravagant meals, in particular during the holy month of Ramadan, that are quite tricky and something we need to be very aware of. So, for example, it said, so people who fast and observe lawful means for eating and drinking, but are excessive to the extent of extravagance, for example, during the iftar, are compared with those who eat and drink from unlawful means. So, you know, this is something that maybe not all of us are aware of. So, you know, we might well be very good at abstaining from eating and drinking during the day, and even abstaining from rude words and all the other bad traits. But look, if we have this sort of blemish-free day of fasting and we've done everything right, we've done all the good things, and then we sit down to a hugely extravagant meal of iftar, it seems that we're actually sort of put in the same group as those people who are eating and drinking from unlawful means. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And so I'm talking about many other reasons why we should keep our iftar simple, and this very deep and sort of very important reason that if we are considered extravagant, so if we're excessive or extravagant in our iftar meals, for example, well, we could apply it to suhoor, of course, too. We're put in the same group as those people who are drinking and eating from unlawful means. And so I'll just sort of explain this a bit more. So these people who do this, they're basically called slaves of their stomachs. We're not slaves of Allah if we're engaging in extravagant iftar meals. And, you know, and many people will have maybe attended or at least be aware of some of these iftar meals where, you know, you have a huge spread, maybe you've got the simple things to break the fast with, and then you sit down to a very lavish meal with all the different vegetables and breads and maybe several meat dishes and so on, and then there comes more after that. So if we're doing that, we are slaves of our stomachs and we're not slaves of Allah, so obviously we don't want to be doing that. And so obviously it also, so these people are then called worshippers of the belly rather than sort of Allah's worshippers. And notice obviously this is so, and we know that lavishness and extravagance is forbidden, and it's considered tantamount to a sin, the same as a sin. So what do we do? So obviously this is something we need to abstain from, definitely. So, inshallah, you bear this in mind, because this is a really important point. We do not want to be grouped with people who are sort of drinking and eating from unlawful things. So please, when it comes to preparing iftar, just remind yourselves of this, inshallah. And so I pray that you gain just some extra reminders from today, and look forward to welcoming you to another episode of HZ here on IB English Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
IRIB English Radio presents The Month of Allah. Let's be with Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abbas Razavian.
As I look to nature's beauty, dazzled am I, knowing everything calls on you, the Lord Most High.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen Wassalatu wassalam ala ashrafil anbiya'i wal mursaleen Sayyidina Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. The month of Allah is the month that we are developing our connection to God. In this month, when we enjoy the different du'as that we read, the different salats that we do, the different prayers that we do, when we read the Holy Qur'an, we have an enjoyment that we didn't have during the other months. Now, this connection to God, we were talking about how it gives us life. It gives us the true essence of human life. According to Aristotelian logic, humans were defined as haywanun natiqun, animals that could speak, animals that would think, and their speech comes from their ability to think. But one of our philosophers and one of the mufassirs and commentators of the Holy Quran said that this is problematic, that human beings should be defined as this, hayyun muta'allihun, that human beings, once they're created, they will live eternally. There's a hereafter for them. And that second of all, the differentia is that humans are muta'allih, they are connected to God. Therefore, for a person to be a true human being in the eyes of religion, it is a human being that is connected to God. And we see this in the traditions. We see that if we were to obey God, God would give us some of the same powers that He has. In some of these traditions, it says, Abdi ati'ni, my servant, follow me, obey me. Aj'aluka mathali or mithli, and I will make you similar to me, I will make you like me, meaning that the same powers that God has, with His permission, He will give it to the humans. Meaning that mankind, when he becomes close to God, when he becomes alive, and he reaches the different stages of being alive, at the end he will become similar to God, he will have the powers of God. So why should we limit ourselves? Why should we only limit ourselves to a material form of being? If human beings have such a potential, isn't it not right for us to limit ourselves to a very low form of life, a very low form of hayat? When we look at other traditions, we read, "Ati'ni fima amartuk, aj'aluka taqulu lashay'in kum fayakun." Follow me in what I have commanded for you, and I will make you say, be and it is. This is one of the verses of the Holy Quran. Be and it is. Allah commands something and it is. So human beings have this potential to reach a very high level of power, even though we're not searching for this power, but this is showing you the potential of humans. Another thing that when you think of life, and this connection, it brings for us absolute joy. How many of us complain that we are not enjoying ourselves? We're not having, you know, a good life in this world. We've seen many of the prophets, many of the scholars, that when they have connected to God, once they have true life, no matter what troubles and tribulations life might bring them, they are still very happy people. Why? Because they have the greatest form of enjoyment. They say, once you reach this form of enjoyment, which is lidhat, which is this connection to God, which is this enjoyment, they cannot compare this to anything. For example, in the traditions, we say from Imam Ali alayhi salam, "In atyaba shay'in fil jannah wa aladhahu hubbullah." What is the most beloved thing in heaven? What is the greatest joy in the hereafter? The narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Loving God, and what? Wa hubba fillah." Wal hubba fillah, meaning that loving in the way of God, loving those that God loves, loving Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, loving his family. These two things are the most important enjoyments in the hereafter. The hereafter is the world, is the realm where the realities of things are open for us. So if live that true enjoyment, it's connecting to them, loving Allah and loving his prophets and loving their successors. We understand that also in this world there is this love, there's this enjoyment. And many of us have felt this during the nights that they have cried for the Prophet, cried for his progeny, and they have connected to them. They feel a great, immense sense of love and joy for them. And then if you ask them, can you change this? Would you exchange this for anything that you have in this world? They'll say, no, we would not. So for us, inshallah, in the remaining days and nights of the month of Ramadan, we want to enjoy life. And we understand that this is the critical part in the definition of human beings. And then this is the way for us to truly enjoy our life and for us to overcome all the calamities and tribulations and problems that we might face. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ahla baytihi tayyibin tahirin.
قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله إن أعجز الناس من عجز عن الدعاء.
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله said, "Verily, the weakest person is the one who is incapable of supplicating."
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله ما لنا رب سوى
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله ما لنا رب سوى
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of distinguished reciters of the Holy Quran in a gathering titled Communion with the Holy Quran. This meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on the first day of the blessed month of Ramadan, March 2nd, 2025. Today, in terms of relations with the world outside our own society, the Iranian nation is faced with a vast front of power-hungry unbelievers or hypocrites. This is the current situation. We don't have problems with other nations. Nations are either brothers with each other, or if they aren't, they leave each other alone. It's the power-hungry who meddle in the affairs of countries and nations. Today, we are among those countries that face a broad front of such power-hungry people. How should we deal with them? The Quran contains guidance on how to deal with them. The Quran makes it clear when we should speak with them, when we should cooperate with them, when we should strike them in the mouth, and when we should draw the sword. All of these are clearly outlined in the Quran. Regarding social issues within the society, our relationships, you know that according to Islam, after monotheism, Islamic understanding, and being connected with God, the most important matter in the formation of an Islamic society is justice, social justice. After monotheism, the prophets didn't invite people to anything as much as they invited them to justice. We have problems in the area of social justice, and the solution to this is in the Quran. In terms of our personal lives and our personal condition, we are afflicted with moral and spiritual diseases. Not just us, but all of the humanity today is suffering from these spiritual and moral ailments. People are afflicted with envy, stinginess, suspicion, laziness, pursuing desires, selfishness, and the tendency to prioritize their own interests over those of the society as a whole. These matters exist among us too, although we are an Islamic society. We have made some progress in certain areas, but at the same time, we also suffer from these afflictions. The remedy lies in the Quran.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The male surgical department inside Nasser Medical Complex in central Khan Yunis, the last haven for those wounded or injured by the Israeli attacks to survive. This place has been turned into blackened ruin as it was targeted last night by the Israeli occupation. At least one airstrike was launched here, destroying this department that was filled with dozens of the patients and the wounded Palestinians who were fighting for their lives. And as the place was set on fire following the attacks, all the patients and the medical crews here were in a state of panic and just rushing to evacuate instantly. But unfortunately, 10 of them, 8 were injured and 2 were killed by this attack, including a 16-year-old child. This place, despite being inside the heart of the Nasser Medical Complex, was deliberately targeted by the Israeli occupation, turning it into ruins.
Hospitals and medical personnel are protected under international and humanitarian law. However, the occupation knows no boundaries or laws. It deliberately targeted this department, rendering it out of service after it had caused the collapse of the medical sector across the Gaza Strip. 2 people were killed, and the rooms in this department, including the oxygen station, were destroyed. This is the only male surgical department here, and now we are forced to treat the remaining wounded, who are now injured for the second time, in inadequate and unsuitable conditions. This is a war crime, and we urge the international community to hold the occupation accountable and prevent such atrocities.
Now, this department is officially out of service. All the patients that were here last night and survived the attack were moved by the medical crews here to other facilities and departments here inside the hospital, where they are now uncertain where exactly and how to receive treatment, because they did survive the previous attacks by the occupation, and now they were targeted again, making them sure that no place is safe in Gaza. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis.
The Israeli bombardment has decimated educational institutions across Gaza and the occupied West Bank, making it nearly impossible for Palestinian students to pursue their studies. Schools and universities have turned to rubble, leaving thousands in despair. But for some, hope still shines. 7 Palestinian students have reached Pakistan to continue their education, with more expected soon.
For Palestinian students, education is not just about degrees. It's about survival. Despite losing their homes and universities, they refuse to let the Israeli war define their future.
Al-Khidmat Foundation has stepped forward, taking full responsibility for their education and living expenses. These students will enroll in different disciplines in Pakistani universities, ensuring that war does not rob them of their dreams.
We are from Gaza. And since the war, Israeli war in Gaza, all the universities are distracted and stop studying, and this will stop the educational process in Gaza. So we are taking this choice to go to Pakistan to continue our studies there.
I'm a teacher assistant at the university. I have studied 5 years of computer engineering at the university, and I came here to continue my studying master degree at data science at university for data science.
This isn't the first time Pakistan has opened its door to Palestinian students. Last year, Palestinian medical students arrived in Lahore, reflecting the resilience of a generation fighting for its future.
We believe education is the strongest form of resistance. We stand with our Palestinian brothers and will ensure they get the education they deserve.